It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing that today. We are talking via Zoom. And today our discussion is all about the art and science of women in STEM. Mark, why don't you introduce our guests and we'll get our conversation going.
That's great. We have wonderful guests with us, four different women from different fields of science, which is really exciting. And on the kind of the ringleader of this, and we'll talk to her more about how she came up with this idea to put women in science together, is Jill Patel. And she's a PhD candidate in medical neuroscience. Welcome, Jill.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And we have Dr. Bandu Bayong, who specializes in clinical innovation and biomedical venture development and entrepreneurship, and is also a AAAS, which is the American Association for the Advancement of Science and Technology Policy Fellow. Wow, what a title, but that's wonderful that you're here with us.
Thank you.
And we also have Ami Bakari, who's a data visualization platform SME. And we're going to figure out what SME is with you all in just a little bit. Well, welcome, Ami.
Welcome, Ami.
Yay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we also have Anna Eglin, who's the principal product partner with the tech company Innovate Map. Welcome, Anna.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
So I wanted to start with Jill, you had an idea to put together before pre-COVID, an idea where we were going to highlight women that worked in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math fields. Can you tell me why was that and what was your concept?
Yeah, so what I noticed when I, you know, started undergrad and started thinking seriously about my career in science, because that's what I was interested in, I noticed that there were a lot of programs that promoted, you know, women in STEM for younger people, high school or younger, wanting to get them involved. But there was this huge discrepancy of once they're in the fields, what do you do with them? Like, how do you support these women in STEM and how do you give them the resources and the support that they can actually climb the ladder and, you know, get positions that are usually reserved for men, kind of higher up in any field. And so basically what I realized is one of the parts of wanting to do this series is that there's this lack of having the support system for women in STEM that are undergrad or higher. So women that we want to retain in STEM. And the other part of this was once I actually started grad school, I started noticing any, you know, challenges that I had, I would usually go towards women to either talk about, to vent to, to go to for advice, to go for support. And I would always get way more out of it. And it's kind of been a huge factor of why I'm still here and working in the STEM fields. And I think that goes to show, it's like a small, you know, case study of what can happen if you have women supporting other women and actually sharing resources and stories that might actually help them stay in STEM fields.
Well, for each of you, what did get you interested in science, and were there women that helped you become curious of science when you were younger? Let's just kind of go through the panel. Anna, we'll start with you.
Yeah. So I actually work in technology. I'm not a scientist and I don't work in science, but to be on this panel with also two amazing scientists and three amazing scientists, I'm so excited. So for me, you know, getting into tech was something I always enjoyed tech. I always enjoyed, you know, we got a computer when I was pretty young, which was very, very exciting for me. But, you know, I never really saw it as a career path for myself because I just don't think I ever saw it reflected in the people around me. You know, I'm from a pretty small town in Indiana. And so everybody I knew had, you know, pretty like traditional TV jobs, like cops, doctors, lawyers, you know, teachers. And I never saw people really working in tech, and I definitely never saw women working in tech, and it wasn't really represented to me. And so then when I, you know, got my liberal arts degree and got out in the world, in the middle of the recession, in 2008, I realized that, you know, there's, you know, I wanted to be in tech. I wanted to work in tech and I wanted to make that career shift. So for me, it really was about going back to school. And I am so grateful for the women that I have worked with throughout my career in tech, because it's not just about having that mentorship, which is so important, but it really, it's about having those people that will advocate on your behalf, because tech is so network driven. It's so much about who you know, startup culture. It's all kind of like the people you went to school with. And that's a lot of the problems we have right now as far as lack of diversity in tech. But you know, it's those people who will advocate for you. And so many women that I've worked with have advocated for me, and now I try to advocate for the women that I work with.
And Du, how about you? What got you interested in it and made you stay with it?
Yeah, great question. You know, I early on was inspired by male mentors. So I wasn't fortunate enough to, you know, encounter women early on that were scientists that I necessarily was trying to emulate. You know, I, you know, our father, Ami's my sister, spoiler alert. our father was a geologist. So that was kind of our first exposure to science, but a completely different type of science. So I knew, you know, you could be a scientist, but it necessarily wasn't something I associated directly with women. But, you know, we had the type of parents that made us feel like we could do anything. And so pursuing particularly medical science, I knew that, you know, women could be doctors, but I didn't have a woman physician to talk to. You know, I knew that women could do these things, but I didn't necessarily have, you know, a woman to talk to me about it until I was much, much older. And even, you know, getting into undergrad and then graduate school, I had few women professors that I very much looked up to, but again, still couldn't necessarily see myself in them. But I definitely knew that, you know, since they were in the field and they were successful, that I could surely emulate the path that they had been in. And once I got further along, that's when I started to get pulled in by women who saw a need, like Jill said, to share their experiences, to be very candid about what goes on in the workplace and along the way. And I think, you know, Jill is right, like people that isn't happening at every stage in STEM. And so that was definitely my experience as well. So, so yeah, I could relate to that.
So Ami, being Bendu's sister and your parents were already in science, did you have a choice to be something other than not involved in the science field?
I did, but it was definitely encouraged for me to try science things because when I was younger, like my sister was obviously like my idol, like my role model. And so as she did biology, she kind of told me about a camp that was at IU and for Hudson and Holland. And then like, that's a biology type of camp. And I went to that and like, I tried, but I kind of knew early on, like science wasn't for me. Like science isn't my thing just because, I mean, I think it's interesting and I admire the people who do it, but it just wasn't for me. It wasn't working out. Grades usually tell you if something is for you or not, and grades really showed me like, this isn't the path for me. So I am also in tech like Anna. And so I will say that I did not have any, there was nobody around me that like did IT or anything like that. So the only exposure that I had to STEM careers was science. And so I didn't actually know about careers in tech, or the only thing I knew about it was like coders. So that's like a common misconception, is that IT is associated with people who code or program, or somebody who actually fixes your computer. And so that is the experience that that's what I saw, but I knew that those weren't things that I was interested in. It wasn't until I got my internship my senior year, and I'd actually gone to undergrad for public financial management, but then I minored in information systems. But the placement that I got, that department was transitioning from the acquisitions and program management department into the strategic information business intelligence department. And while I was there, I got to work with data, and I got to work alongside people who really liked what they were doing, and I loved it. And my manager at the time was like, this is a career, like you could have a career doing this if you like it. And so that is what inspired me to get my master's degree. But that manager was a man. There was no women that I was working with there. I think maybe there was one woman there, and she would kind of like do data cleansing, but I didn't actually get exposure to women in various parts of tech until I joined the company where I work now, which is a larger pharmaceutical company. And this is the first time in my life where I've actually been able to seek out women mentors and understand like people in security, or people that are in the data visualization space, or they did like all these different types of IT. I didn't have that until 3 years ago.
Yeah, and I mean, you get Anna to some degree, you also do, but I mean, you really cross over because you're in data visualization into the arts field. So it's much about creating an artistic representation of data as it is the tech side.
Oh, for sure.
So while I still have you, what is SME?
So it's a subject matter expert.
Ah, good. So we can go around.
Yeah.
We can add SME to after hours if we know something that really well, right?
Yeah, go for it.
Great.
I like that. Let's take that cross platforms.
Exactly. Go ahead, Jill.
Jill, was this what you expected to hear when you started your project and interviewing women?
In terms of like what got them interested?
Well, that, yeah. And the fact that there wasn't a lot of female mentorship early on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, for me, it's a little similar and different in terms of that I grew up in a single parent household. So I have a single mother who raised me and my two older sisters. So I was always surrounded by women. But some of my best mentors have been men. And, you know, these are people who actually got me interested and then kept me interested in science enough to keep going. So I had like a nice combination. And I also, just from talking to people, like their reasons for why they come into the fields are all different based on their different experiences. But yeah, the mentorship, like the one thing that I've noticed is it's all different for everyone. But I also feel like at some point you do always benefit once you start, you know, talking to other women in the field. It doesn't have to be a mentor, but once you actually start interacting with other women that are in your field or outside of it, that there are certain things that you become more knowledgeable in, or, you know, just by sharing experiences, which is part of this project, you just become more aware and it's less isolating. And that's part of this project is, there was a time in science where I just felt very isolated. And it wasn't until I reached out to other women and they were like, oh yeah, I deal with the same stuff like every single day. And I was like, okay, great. I mean, you know, part of it is trying to find a solution to it. But part of it is just knowing that there are literally everyone around you is going through similar kinds of things, similar challenges and difficulties, and they are coming out of it somehow. So they must be doing something that helps them, mm-hmm. you know, deal with situations like that.
And knowing that, how has that helped each of you once you've met these other women that are experiencing these same things? How has that affected your confidence in your work, in your daily life and with your work? Anna?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with what Jill said. I mean, you know, sometimes it's, you know, it's just nice to have another woman in the room to be like, did you hear that thing? Am I hearing that thing correctly? You know, did you see that thing happen? Was that was weird, right? Like, I'm not imagining this. So just having another person, I think, who has a little bit of like a shared perspective or is kind of coming from the same place, because, you know, we all see things a little bit differently. That's so important. But I think, you know, having that community, it's not just, you know, the community of like, you know, people similar to you, it's the people who are kind of experiencing similar things. One of the best books that one of my female friends, like professional, like mentors as well, recommended to me is called Feminist Fight Club. I'm not sure if anyone has read this book, but it is one of the, I don't want to say it was transformational for me, because that's probably way too strong of a word, but it's all about how you as a woman in the workplace can support the women around you. And it gives you these little tactical tips and tricks to say, when you hear a woman being talked over, you stop everything and you say, hey, you know, what did you say? It's just like these small things that you can do to kind of empower the women around you. And so for me, that was something that was really important, of not just, you know, being able to have that camaraderie, but ensuring that if I do encounter any power in a situation, I am using it to appropriately empower the women around me.
And how does that work for the others of you that have been able to do something like that? What's the reception from the men in the room when something like that happens?
That's funny that you bring that up. I didn't know what that was called, but I've had that done for me several times. So I think, you know, I'm in between, you know, I'm not super young, but I'm not very old. And I think what tends to happen if you are in a room, because there's an age component on top of, you know, race, gender, like it's all there, right? And so you might be in a situation where someone who is maybe in a more privileged group can step in when they see that you're being talked over, or someone repeats your idea and then gets praise for it. You know, I noticed, you know, people doing that for me. And so it's just interesting to hear what it's called, and maybe that is where they got it from. But you recognize that other people are in tune to it happening, and they are trying to you know, kind of help you. I have not yet been in the position to now do that for someone else, but I know that it makes you feel seen and heard. And I hope that I get to be in a position to do that for another.
Yeah, you know, the first thing that any of us learn when we go through any kind of, you know, diversity training or any training on race and those, is that you really need to be able to speak for someone in terms of giving them an entrance. It's not speaking for them. I've got the wrong wording, but you know what I mean? You need to be able to speak up and say, wait a minute, I'm offended. And that includes males in the room. That includes the white males that are sitting there. That includes any males should also be giving voice to women, saying, I think we're missing something. We're not hearing this voice. And so I think you all have that experience. One thing I'm curious about with all of you, though, you're in really advanced fields of study within what you do. And we see many, many more women going into like medicine, medical field. We're seeing an increase in doctors. But you guys are scientists. You don't really see it there either, do you? You don't see as many women in science as you might in the medicine field. Is that true?
So I think, you know, it's the perception, right? So you're actually getting more and more women graduating with, you know, bachelor's degrees in the sciences. That is starting to actually overtake males. If you look at medical graduating classes, like you said, those women are represented there. But even in the biomedical sciences, you are seeing more and more women getting master's, PhDs. The problem is, like Jill, I think, touched on, is that so-called pipeline is very leaky. So women will have these degrees, and if you talk to them 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, are in a role that is not related to what they obtained their degree in. And so it's not that it's rare. Women love science and technology, love engineering, and math just as much as males, right? And they go have these big ideas and big thoughts and go to college wanting to pursue those things. There is something that does not help maintain women in these spaces. And there's tons of reasons we probably don't have to go into, but so yeah, I think that, you know, it's a misnomer sometimes where people think that women aren't in these fields. Like, women are in these fields. It's just that if we go down to, you know, 10, 15 years, 20 years from now, when you're tenured professors and your PIs that have been there for however many years, then yes, you're going to start to see fewer and fewer just because they didn't stick around.
That's what we're talking about today, the challenges and the successes of women in STEM. And we're going to take a short break and then be back with more of our conversation right after this.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
And welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And today we're talking about the art and science of women in STEM with PhD candidate Jill Patel and Dr. Bindu Bayon, Anna Eglin, and with Ami. You know, when we left, we were talking a little bit about what I think was just an amazing vision for me of a leaky pipeline. In other words, it isn't that we don't get women attracted into it or even get them through school. We do that. We're successful at that. But we don't seem to retain them. So somewhere along the way, we're losing women. I want to talk a little bit more about why that is. What is it? Is it? And I think part of it might be Jill's onto. Maybe there are a lack of mentors as well at senior positions. I just don't know. But you all would know more about it. But we have a little conversation about the leaky pipeline.
Yeah, Ami, how about you? Let's start with you.
Yeah, sure. So what I will say is that in tech, there are women that join that field and there are women that, you know, go to school for that and really enjoy that. But it has been my experience because I was a report developer on a team where I was the only woman. And then I was also the only Black person on the entire team. So I was only a Black woman developer. And I noticed a lot of resistance to like my ideas or being heard on the team and that kind of thing. And I could tell that if I were a different type of person that were easily deterred from difficult situations, I would have left. I mean, I switched out of that role, but I mean, I would have left doing developmental work just because it's a very male dominated field. And there's not even, and then in addition to that, also just the racial factor, there's like relatively no Black women that do kind of the work that I do. And so being in that position where you're already, women don't get heard as often in the workplace, or when women have, like I had a colleague on the team, was another woman, and she would bring things up. Like she would be like, I think maybe this isn't going to work. And nobody would listen to her. So I found myself being in a position to be able to support her and be like, you know what, guys, I think she's not making it up. I think we should listen to her. But there's not a lot of that going on. And so if you are not a determined woman, if you are not a strong woman, you can easily get discouraged and want to go to an area where your dimensions of difference would be more appreciated. And so I think that that plays into that leaky faucet analogy, because you would just go somewhere else where people would more value you.
How about the others of you? Have you other things that you think are causing that leaky pipe kind of thing?
Yeah, I would 100% agree with what Ami said. I see the exact same thing. I think it's one of those things where, you know, more and more women are coming into tech, and you hear this a lot in, you know, like engineering programs in college where there's more women, but, you know, a lot of the environments are kind of hostile and they're not super positive. And so women start to drop out. And I think as you go higher and higher in tech, I agree, like tech has a much better representation, I think, of women than a lot of other of the STEM fields at points, but the higher you get, the less women there are. So you get to like the C-suite and there's very, very few. And I think as women kind of drop off in that pipeline, it gets harder and harder to kind of sustain these environments. I mean, you know, I work with a lot of startups and I see them form and I see, you know, how, you know, a company with, you know, one white male founder all of a sudden is seven white males. And that's not a really fun environment for anyone who wants to walk into that. And, you know, and I've heard these conversations where it's like, oh, we gotta hire a woman now. Like, oh, shucks, you know, it's not the boys club anymore. And it's like, that's not fun to hear. That's not great to hear that, you know, you're coming in to kind of ruin everybody's fun. So, I mean, I totally agree. It's that difference between diversity and inclusion, right? And diversity, like they say, is, you know, you're invited to the dance, but inclusion is like somebody asks you to dance, right? Like there's totally different requirements to actually feel a part of a team and feel a part of a culture.
Yeah, I think I see that so often. You're exactly right, both of you, in that, it's really sometimes a top-down decision to be, we're going to be in, not inclusive, but we're going to be diverse. And so at management levels below that, that isn't an agreement. That is just something that they have to do. And so what ends up happening, and we see that on race and other things, what ends up happening is we get compliance, which is far, far away from really trying to include people. So mm-hmm. I think you guys are right. I was pleasantly surprised, I don't know if any of you saw, but this year when Apple did their event, there were, for the first time, there were two vice presidents on stage that were women. That's a huge change, because when Steve Jobs used to be there, there was no women on stage. And so I think there are some shifts. I see it at Microsoft and some others. So you're right, Anna and Ami, that there's beginning to be some change, but we need many, many more women that are at positions that they can push that acceptance and inclusion down.
And to call out too, like it's getting better for women, but like it's mostly getting better for white women. Like women of color are horribly absent from that. I mean, it's even worse.
I agree.
How do you change the minds of the white men in charge then? Because there seems that's part of the problem, isn't it? How do you still do your job the way you want to do it? With confidence, with helping others, and helping them just to see things a little differently. That's a lot. That's a big burden on your shoulders when you're just trying to do your work.
I think, I love what Anna mentioned about, you know, being in a diverse environment, like, isn't enough, and you want inclusion. And that's talked about often as feeling like you're involved. And I think, I don't remember where I heard this comparison, but what we actually want is a step further. Like, I don't want to be at the dance or be asked to dance. I want to help plan the dance. I actually want to be there when you are deciding there's going to be a dance, when there is going to be a dance, where it's going to be held, who gets invitations. I want to be part of what creates the dance. And I think that for a long time, as Mark touched on, people have thought, you know, if we just let a few more in here, that'll be great, because they'll be here and they'll be at the table. And we realize that's not enough, right? Because the techniques that we've already touched on happen, where you get spoken over or your ideas get brushed to the side. So being in the room is not enough, right? And so then even, you know, being heard in the room isn't enough if your ideas don't, you know, don't translate into action. And so I think that the issue is not with women ourselves. And I don't believe that it is women's jobs to change the thinking of men. We have been brilliant, innovative, and, you know, very team oriented for millennia. And men actually do know that. It's a power structure that people with power don't want to give up. And so it's not, I don't think, an issue of trying to convince or coax, or I'm sure there are groups that were all white men and then they invited a woman and that woman changed things for the better 10 times over. And they didn't really see the need to, oh, let's get another woman. Like, it never crossed their mind to do that. And so I think it just does start with men and them making the decision that this is the way we want the culture to be here. And these are the steps we're going to take. But I don't think, and maybe this is just me, but I don't think that there is much women can do to change those environments from the top down, because I do think that it's a top down mentality. There are things that we can do to improve environments for each other. But I think with some of these larger companies in academia as well, and in other sectors, it is going to be up to the white men among us to decide that they want this to change.
How viable is it then for women in STEM to create their own companies, to create their own organizations, as opposed to working with companies that are already established? What kind of opportunities are there for that out there?
Well, I mean, I do think that there is something to having your own, so to speak. And I think that what you're starting to see, you know, Anna talked a little bit about, you know, startup culture. You know, there are women who have formed, you know, venture capitalist groups that they are groups of women who want to invest their money in companies that are comprised of women or are promoting technologies that will benefit women. And so you see women that are in these power positions because a lot of this is centered around power and money and who has it and who's able to make decisions. And so when women have been fortunate enough to get to that point, turning around and empowering other women, you know, I have started to see that. I think, you know, the black community, the Latinx community is you know, trying to follow, you know, in that path. There are barriers, but there is something to being able to support other people like you outside of the constructs and the confines of the stereotypical white male structure that exists. What I will say is that we still need those white men, because they have the keys, right? They have the keys. And so being mentored and sponsored by those white men that have, you know, that are gatekeepers to certain information, that network that's so valuable that was talked about earlier, well, you can't do that alone, right? So you need them. And so I think there's a benefit to, you know, having our own and kind of doing some things on our own, but bringing those white men along with us or making sure they bring us along with them is also very important, because what boardrooms look like they're going to be the majority for some time. And so we still need them to so-called teach us your ways so that we can, you know, that we can be included as well.
Yeah, and I think you're all talking about one of the more important things to encourage anyone along the way that is an underrepresented group, and that is that the one that's in power has to find voices within them and beliefs that they actually do believe in, not just, it's better for the company or something we should do, but they really believe that we'll be better because of women and that women have a contributing voice. And I find that all the time. So men have to be able to step out there and say something. I'm curious though, there was a report that I read in Science, Bingdu, you'll know a little bit about this, but in the Association of Science, AAAS, that was on women, a whole huge thing in one of their recent journals on women during COVID in STEM, and particularly in some science areas. And when people had to go home, particularly in academics, when people had to stay home and work, the women primarily had to go back to doing childcare. And means that they were doing less in the world of publishing. And the men used it as an opportunity to publish more. That was what the study did. So we still have a long way to go in our home settings as to what are our roles like when that happens. And what does that mean? Because that means that a woman who is publishing less is not going to advance. It even speaks to a systemic problem that advancement is based on publishing. But there's all kinds of issues there. Can any of you speak to that? Like, Jill, I know that that has to be something you think about. You don't have children now, but I'm sure that there are other women that do.
Yeah, no, I've spent a lot of my time taking care of my nephew. Nowhere close to having my own kid at all, but like the time I've had to give to that, I've noticed just from that how stressful it is. And we have, you know, women in my lab and like other labs that I've heard about who not necessarily miss out, but I've definitely heard comments about, oh, she's having another kid. Like this is going to be a whole year that she's not going to be able to do something. And meanwhile, like, you know, some of these women have done the most, even with kids. And like, that is not the problem. I think the problem is, just like I said, like, how do we set up our system? And I'll talk about academia specifically, like if you're going to have a place where women can work, you've got to have a place where they can come after they've given birth and like have rooms to, you know, breastfeed or pump or whatever, and have the time and the space to actually take care of their kids and then be able to do their job because they're capable of doing both. And so I've followed this whole, you know, people once they've had to do quarantine, have had to really work on how they figure out childcare with their spouses. And that it's been an issue. And obviously like the data that you read in Science suggests that it's mainly women who are missing out here. And I think it's probably one of those many reasons why women don't feel supported necessarily. Because, you know, even without kids, I have the potential to have kids someday. And that, like, even for me right now, that makes me really nervous that when I'm working a full career after my PhD, am I going to be passed over for jobs that people are afraid that I would miss out, you know, work because I have kids. And that's kind of a mindset that's like embedded into any culture, I think. STEM fields probably even outside. And it's really hard to tell people or show people that it's not, that that's not really the problem. That if you fully support these women, they're gonna have no problems doing their job. So yeah, it's something that I'm concerned about, like for myself, and then I've seen it everywhere. So I'm concerned for other women who have to deal with this day to day.
Anna, you just had a new baby, didn't you?
Yes, my situation is a little different though, because I have a wife at home with me. So she actually had the baby. Yeah, I don't know. It's funny, these mom conversations, I'm not sure exactly how I fit in. I am a mom to a new baby, although not a birth mother. So, I think about that a lot. I think it gives me a little bit of a different perspective, but, personally I'm grateful to be able to be home. So I can be home with my wife and baby during the pandemic. But yeah, I mean, I see exactly what you're talking about. I mean, you know, I have coworkers right now who are trying to balance homeschool and work and doing these things. And I have one coworker, I mean, she set blocks on her calendar and she's like, during these times, I'm doing virtual learning. I don't have a choice. And like my workplace has been extremely accommodating to that. So we don't book her during those times. And I think that that's like, it's just kind of a thing where we all just have to kind of be aware it's happening and be more accommodating. And, you know, talking about, you know, supporting women in the workplace, I mean, we have no, there's no family leave. Like, you know, my wife is off for 3 months, but she's got FMLA because she's technically governmentally classified as disabled for 3 months with no pay. So, I mean, why would companies do anything to take this seriously when we as a country don't take this seriously?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it crosses all careers too. It's not just for STEM, but it's a real big hole in that pipe of the leakiness that you guys are talking about, because all of a sudden the challenges start to overcome the opportunities. And how do we get past that? How do we help each other to move past that so we continue to not only offer all these opportunities for young women in these fields that are the future, but to help them along? And I mean, Jill, obviously that's, you know, the research that you're doing and that you're finding there.
It also seems to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels a little like we still are hiding behind women being able to be successful and still have children. In other words, it's still a perception that comes from the people in power, from the white male majority. In other words, you can't balance those, because I couldn't, or, you know, traditionally that couldn't be. And then yet, in fact, well, a lot of the men I know that go home and they have a traditional marriage and they go home to that and they're there and their wife is taking care of anything, they don't work very hard. You know, they say they're working really hard at work. They don't work all that hard. Women really are working hard when they're at work, because that's the amount of time they have. So I think, Jill, it's back to your point. I do think it's an interesting cultural thing. And Anna, same way, at a much larger structural level, with even within the government, as to what do we reward, what don't we? You know, having children should be a reward for both spouses.
Yeah.
It's something we need to think about.
Yeah. Can I just call it back real quick to what we were talking about with, like, how do you get white men to do something or to talk about this? And I think something like this, if we ever discuss, you know, problems like this, I think instead of the default being, oh, you're complaining or this is not a big deal, that the default should be for white men to go, okay, I never knew about this because I've never had to deal with this. But now that you're telling me this, I hear you, I believe you, and let's actually try to do something about it. And then when you reach that point where you've understood what's going on and you're ready, then you would finally, at that point, you would employ women, in my opinion, to like be in the leadership positions to actually do something about this. And that's how, you know, even with diversity, that's what I see. If it's not our job to teach anyone anything, because there's plenty of resources out there, but then once you've read and you've understood and you're ready to make change, then you should always default to, you know, the diverse population or the women in STEM, whatever problem you're fixing, because they are going to be better equipped to actually offer solutions that will work.
Right, you live it, you have the experience.
Completely. So just going off of what Jill is saying, so it has been my experience. So I have a 3-year-old daughter, and being in a male-dominated type of environment, being on that team where I was the only woman developer, it often came up, like, being in IT, the people want you to be like a customer service type of person. You're pretty much always on. So if something is broken, they want you to fix it. If, you know, some calculation is off, they want you to get on it. And I found it really difficult to be that, because I wanted to come home and also be a mom. But then the other two guys, like, they had kids, but, and so my manager at the time would be like, oh, I mean, you guys all have kids. And I had to actually explain to him, like, we all have kids, but, like, are they going home to breastfeed their kid? Right. Are they going home to, like, actually, like, breastfeed them and then, like, pump and then, like, put that milk away and then, like, get your food for tomorrow? I was like, they're not doing those things. I know they're not. So, like, but I am. So, like, please don't call me at 7:30. But then what I agree on, the whole, like, changing the actual structure of the environment, because on that team, it was very much so like, oh, we wanted to chat all day. Like everybody wanted to, it was very techy. Like people wanted to talk and chit chat all day. And I kind of wouldn't do that because I was like, well, I have to go home at a certain time and be a mom. But then I would kind of get, you know, bad or feedback that was like, oh, you're not talking a lot. Like we're not getting, you're not making us feel like you're a team player. And I was like, well, I can't do that because I have to go home and be a mom. But even that understanding, he didn't have that until I explained it to him. Because a lot of times what I've seen in my area is a lot of men, their wives are stay-at-home moms. So a lot of like managers, directors, all that stuff where I work, their wives don't work. So for them, when they are thinking of like what momming is, they're thinking of what their own wife has done. But then I had to kind of explain like, well, I'm also a wife, but see how I'm just here with you during the day. Like I'm also working with you. I also have kids. So like at a certain time, I want to go home and be a mom. But that understanding isn't there unless more white men start to try to ask those questions, to try to understand, you know, why is it that maybe you can't participate on the team like maybe I have in my mind that you should. So it's that willingness to understand that different perspective that will open up a lot of doors. And then also just hiring more diverse talent, because if my manager had been a woman, for example, or somebody else who had a child or who was in a relationship where their wife wasn't a stay-at-home mom, then maybe they would have understood where I was coming from. But hiring people like a white man that your wife is a stay-at-home mom, then that's one perspective that you have. And now that's how you're going to treat everybody, but everybody doesn't fit into that box.
We are talking about the challenges and the successes of women in STEM. And today we want to remind you that our program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and the community can come together for unique activities and conversations. And we're going to continue ours in just a moment. Stay tuned.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Well, welcome back. We're continuing our conversation about women in STEM. And Jill, we started this whole conversation off talking about the project and your podcast that you've created and the importance of networking. How have you found networking to be a benefit for you with your career and furthering it in STEM?
It has been pretty much how I've gotten every job of mine. Every single person, you know, the first time I worked in a lab, it was someone my mom worked with previously in the hospital. That person then led me to my current mentor. All of the people I meet right now have kind of pointed me towards people for collaboration. So it's pretty much all word of mouth. Like I've barely had to like write an email where I didn't know someone. And then like that led to something. So I'd say like, networking amongst people you know, which I guess is networking, but you know, through other contacts is really the best way I've found to advance in my career.
And for the rest of you, has that helped you as well when it comes to both networking with women and with men, both in STEM fields? Or are you, as Jill's kind of finding that we need more women mentors out there to help network?
I think both of those things are true, but especially in tech, it is so highly, highly network driven. I mean, again, you know, you see startups where the first four people are like one person and their cousin and then their cousin's friend and then their partner, you know? And so it's all about who you know, but like, so I run a group called Out in Tech, and it's for queer people in tech in Indianapolis to connect and get to know each other. And the goal of Out in Tech is that so all these people can come together and we can literally know each other and we can know each other's networks. Because when a job comes open, you're always like, hey, didn't I meet someone or don't I meet someone? So you want to be sure that, you know, that we, I want to make sure that we all know each other. I want to make sure that we all have each other in mind when these jobs come open. Because if you do not, if you don't diversify your tech networks, then you're just going to keep hiring the same people, reaching out to the exact same people. It's absolutely critical.
I think what I've seen, you know, over the years is that my male colleagues network differently. And I tried to, you know, see, you know, observe the way that they form these groups and try to copy it. I found them to be a little bit more aggressive with how they introduce themselves to people. So I think, you know, we're told that, you know, you need that soft handoff, you know, this person gives you the email introduction or that person knows this person. But when I realized that folks were just going up to people at conferences, you know, if you couldn't get that person, getting somebody in their office, looking them up online, finding out who else works in that department, emailing those people until someone emails you back, showing up, you know, things that you're like, that's inappropriate. Who would ever do that? People, depending on the field, will interpret that as you're a go-getter, you are persistent, you are determined. So they'll take these signs of reaching out and turn those into qualities that they want to see in an employee or a trainee. And so I realized that other people were doing it, and I really had a what can I lose attitude about all of it. You know, even though, you know, we had a father who was a scientist, our mother wasn't able to go to college there. We're first generation, you know, our parents are immigrants. We don't have a connect, we don't have a network outside of our actual parents, you know? And so I realized like, we're going to have to just build a network and just, again, what do you have to lose? So, you know, I would be the person that would just go up to someone afterwards or say, I've heard of you, you know, can we talk? Sometimes they'll say no, but sometimes they're like, you're the only person who asked me today. And you realize that, you know, people have more respect for that than we're ever told. And you don't realize that that is what some of your male counterparts are doing that you're not doing. And that has gotten me a lot of opportunities, have opened a lot of doors for me, just from being the slightest bit more aggressive than the next person.
It's not really being aggressive. You're being confident. You're actually sharing yourself. But because of a woman, they're going to think that maybe you're being aggressive. Yep.
Well, I was going to say there's a fine line, obviously, there, because look at, we have an incredible, whether you are Democrat or not, we have an incredibly qualified candidate for vice president running in the Democratic Party. But look at where people are going with that. They're dinging at that she somehow had to get there some false way. You know, either too aggressive, being like a male, or she, you know, awful other things that they're saying. It just really, really bothers me. And so there is this level of doing that. You know, one thing that I heard from all of you that I wanted to make sure we got in here was to the white males that are in our audience listening, this is a chance, an opportunity to do something, to act. This is a chance to use your power for good, to be able to do something. So we're not trying to ding you. We're trying to tell you, you can do something and you can make a difference in the world and you're important. And I think that's important for us to say as a part of what we're doing. And that's part of your message is, okay, treat us as treat us as a part of who you are. Make us equals. Be something that you want me on your team because you're great. Nobody likes to be that one, you know, that's left at the end that gets picked for the baseball team. So it's really great.
Very quickly, Gilles, the podcast, where can we hear it? Where can we share it?
So it's on the Da Vinci Pursuits website. I believe it's under the connections. It's a woman in STEM tab. So they actually are video casts. So you will be able to see the video or if you just want to listen to the audio, but that's where you can find them.
Well, we want to thank you. Thank you, Jill, for being our guest today. Thank you, Bandu. Thank you, Ami. Thank you, Anna. I think we've all learned a lot. And as usual, our conversations have gone into many different areas, Mark, which is what we like the most about this, don't we?
We do. And you can find pictures of our guests, of projects, including the links to the Women in STEM part of our website on the DaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls. So artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.